Have you washed your hands?
Yes.
The left one or the right one?
Both. Both.
I mean, you did touch Sam Altman.
I'll give you that one. That was pretty good. Yes, I did touch Sam Altman on the shoulder. Yes.
Let's elaborate before it gets a bit creepy and weird. But yeah, let's get deeper into that conversation.
Last week I was in Melbourne, and Tausif sends me a message on WhatsApp saying that there's an event that Sam Altman is going to be at. And it turns out, it was going to be like a couple of days from when I saw the message. So I was like, yeah, sure, I'll go and do it. So essentially it was a startup culture event held by a group in Melbourne. And the backstory behind it is actually quite interesting. So Sam was doing this world tour. I think he covered like 22 countries in like a few weeks. It was like hectic. So his last stop was Australia, but then he had nowhere to go. There wasn't a plan yet. So essentially this group found out about it. They reached out to a guy that knew his PR and he's like, yeah, sure, I'll come down for it. So they only knew 8 days in advance, so they had to set up the attendance and, like, you know, get everything going in 8 days and organize all of that. And it was an actual massive turnout. So I guess I'll just tell the story. So first I get there, I'm actually with my sister at the time, and she got a ticket last minute. But then by the time she got her ticket, they were like, oh, maybe you have to wait a bit because there might be some people. So we're like, okay, whatever. It's Sam Altman. It's not going to be that many people. Who knows him? So I get up to the front desk and I'm like, oh, here's my ticket. And they're like, are you to go? One of the guys. And I was like, sure am. I was like, oh man, like I watch your videos and everything. So he knew who I was. And then the guy next to him was like, I know you from somewhere. It's like Cold Fusion. I was like, yeah. So I get talking to these guys and they're just talking about how they weren't meant to be there on the front desk either. It was kind of just a hodgepodge thing at the last minute. So end up going inside the main auditorium. And it's just the front row with the reserved seats. And then it's just I'm at the first row and there was like hardly anyone else. And I was like, oh, it's not going to be that many people. But then within like 10 minutes, the whole place is packed. Wow. And it turns out there was 2,000 people and there's a line in the convention center, like outside, like for people trying to get in at the last minute. So my sister didn't end up getting in and so many other people didn't as well. But it just kind of went to show that, you know, it was a big deal that he was coming to Australia. And it turns out just before he came to this event, a couple of hours beforehand, he was actually meeting with the Prime Minister.
Wow.
So the Prime Minister found out he was coming and then after the fact was like, oh, you got to see me. So it was like, yeah, it was really wild. But anyway, so the actual event, actually just before that, I get handed this VIP thing for a meet and greet afterwards. Yeah. And I was like, this is crazy. I'm going to get to meet the guy. This is going to be nuts. Anyway, so he goes on stage and they're just having some you know, soft questions, Q&A, like what is his interests, what's he like doing, some of the cars he likes. But then it starts getting into more of the serious stuff and what he's been doing on this latest campaign when he's touring the world. And essentially he's just been saying he's been going around and asking people from different countries what they think of ChatGPT and how they can improve it. And there were some things that he'd never thought about, like, for example, the number of tokens it takes to write a message in Japanese is like 20 times more than English. It's like, okay, we've got to fix that. And, you know, just other things about different languages and how that kind of works out for the benefit of the consumer. And then it got to like question and answer time. And a lot of people were asking, you know, what do you see for the future? How can a startup in Australia kind of get on the scene of AI? And his main overall view of the situation was just don't wait, just get in now and use AI and figure out how it works for you and your workflow. And he was extremely bullish on AI. Mm. He said that there's no doubt it's going to like fix climate change and like change all of medicine. He was like, yeah, that's a given. But he's like, what I'm most excited for is the new scientific breakthroughs that come from using AI. And I was like, that's a good point. And that is one of the most exciting things. Like that's, you know, that could just change the world again, in a short amount of time. So overall, it was interesting hearing what he had to say about things and his demeanor on stage and actually having him in person. He's a lot smaller than I thought he would be, actually. So
I think there's something common that I've seen with a lot of people that I would have seen online and then seeing them in real life later, especially like athletes and musicians, like, so they're not as big as they appear on TV, like strange. In terms of structure.
Yes, So afterwards, there was so they finished the question and answer session, and he walked off the stage, and there was like a little booth to the side, and he was packed and swarmed with people. There was like 50 people trying to get his autograph and like take photos with him. And me and a few of the organizers are standing there kind of looking at this, and we're like, oh, I feel sorry for the guy, you know, like he's just come off this long tour and all these people are trying to swamp. And one girl was like, well, at least it's like not some random TikToker or something. This is a guy who's like doing something important. And I was like, yeah, I guess that's a good idea. I mean, good point. And then after that, for a little while, that was like 10 minutes or so. And then there was the VIP thing, which I got the tag from one of the organizers to attend. And it was the same deal here. So there was like different tables and people were standing around. And everywhere he went, there was just people trying to get photos with him. And then by the end, he was like in a corner of the room with people just around him trying to get a photo. And I was talking to one of the organizers and I was like, oh, I'd love to get a photo, but I feel really bad. Like he's had so many people trying to hound him for it. So essentially, at that moment, I was like, okay, I'll just do it like a quick one. It's going to be all right. And then he like had enough at that point. Yeah. He literally left and like walked past me. And then I tapped him on the shoulder just to say like, oh, good, like a word of encouragement or something, good job or something. But yeah, and then he was out of there and left with his detail and left the building. So
it's quick interaction.
Yeah, that's all I got. But overall, it was very interesting seeing him and also just the reaction to him in a live setting. So it was so
you can finally confirm that he is a human being after all.
Well, an advanced robot, maybe, but 99.99% human being, yes.
Fair enough. So very, I guess, useful, productive trip for you to Melbourne. That wasn't the purpose.
Well, that was not the purpose, but...
it was all last minute as well, because when I got when I sent you the text, it was just the day after or was it the same day?
It was the day after.
Because even I didn't know about it.
Yeah, I was like, how did you actually find out about that?
So basically, I'm part of this group, which is about Bangladeshis living abroad. And there's one about Australia, right? So this is basically about the diaspora of the country for Bangladesh. And we just, you know, talk about the industry and whatnot. And I just joined like that group, like, you know, this week. And it was a new thing anyway. And one of the guys who lives in Melbourne is like, hey, you know, this thing's happening with Sam Altman supposed to be there. Any of you guys going there? And I'm like, I wish. But immediately I was like, wait, Dagu was in Melbourne. So the first thing I did was just forward the link to you. And I guess, you know, that just worked out. So the power of networking, I guess.
Power of the internet.
Power of the internet. But other than that, you've been keeping well, because obviously we've even done this in a couple of weeks time.
Yeah. I have been keeping well.
More or less.
Today. But past week I've been quite ill.
Weather, man. It's the I think it's the weather.
It was cold in Melbourne.
It's cold. I mean, is it colder here or cold?
Oh, definitely colder over there.
Really?
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, that's what people say anyway. Yeah. But it just feels really cold in Perth.
Right. Well, trust me, it's colder there. And you get this icy wind that's it's horrendous.
Everyone else in the US is thinking, listen to this, like, what are they talking about? Cold.
The sun's out.
Yeah.
I'm sure by this stage, everyone knows that the hemispheres have, like, are there people that still don't? Like,
I mean, they do, but it never comes off as something that you think about until you get, interacting with somebody who's experiencing it. Right. So that's what usually happens. Because for us, when we move to Australia, when we come to Australia, that's the reality. Mm-hmm. I mean, but for the rest of the world, that's something like they don't really think about as much.
That's probably true, yeah. Yeah, so recovering now, I may cough a few times, but excuse that.
Well, I mean, obviously you took a flight here. Have you seen the thing that's been going around with the double-decker seats?
Oh, yeah, I did actually. I only saw like an image like on Instagram or something.
Same. Yeah, and people just been going nuts about it. People just been going nuts about it, like just really smacking it to the ground. Like, oh, it's so bad. But like, what are your thoughts?
I have to see the image in front of me again, but my impression was that it was okay. Yeah, but like,
I thought so too.
Yeah.
So for anyone of those who don't know what we're talking about, we'll try and put a picture on the YouTube video. But for those listening in, that's basically almost like a double-decker style seating arrangement for airplanes where you've got the usual people sitting, and there's one kind of right in front of you and top of you, and then there's one right underneath you as well. I think if you look at the picture, it'll give it a better understanding. But yeah, that's what was just going around this week, and I was thinking, you know, like it's not the worst idea in the world, but on the internet, everybody hated it.
Well,
90% of the comments were just.
But I think that's just the internet. Like anything that's different, it kind of destroys.
We're going to talk about the internet.
But before we move on, though, I did forget one point on the Sam Altman situation. So exclusive news here. You heard it first. Nowhere else in the world.
Okay.
Sam Altman was asked the question, if Elon Musk was to come back to you and want to take part in OpenAI again, would you work together? And it's like, definitely yes. So we'll see what happens. Because, I was thinking like, yeah, maybe they had some bad blood or something, but it seems like they could get back together. So
I mean, this is a good question, to be fair.
Yeah.
Especially after what he's been saying out publicly and whatnot. So, okay. I mean, the first course of action, it might be like, what have you done this week? Is the question that he asked Sam. So he'll have to be prepared for interactions like that. Other than that... this is actually a question that came from a community post we did on YouTube by at TJLen3157. Have you seen the Black Mirror stuff yet?
Yeah.
Have you had a chance?
Oh, yeah. I've seen the first two episodes.
I haven't.
You haven't?
I haven't had the time.
Okay.
Your thoughts overall?
So I think I was thinking about this as I watched it. I think the situations that they put the characters in are amazing, like really good, well thought out. It's like, oh, that's an interesting concept. But I think sometimes the execution, especially in the first episode, like felt like some bits were a bit too long for what they were trying to explain.
Sure.
And the beats felt like a comedy, but it wasn't funny.
Right.
And it was just like this...
mismatch.
Yeah. Kind of thing. And like it let it down a little bit, but I think the overall concept is solid. So it's a bit disappointing so far, but... Early days yet, so I got to keep watching, I guess.
Oh, fair enough. Yeah. No, it's I'm yet to get into it. I've just got so many things on my list after Succession. So,
I'm still going, by the way. Sorry.
Are you still going?
Yeah, with Succession.
We can't talk about it much because one person commented like every time, because he's like me. I forget the comment, but whoever commented is like me, where anytime something comes up about a show that you want to watch, you just tune off.
Right.
And it's like, the amount of time Tosif brings up Succession, I think I have to stop listening to this podcast. So I'm not going to talk about it anymore because it's over. We'll talk about it off air. I did watch Spider-Man, which is brilliant.
Braden was telling me about it.
We were meant to watch all three of us together.
I haven't seen the first one.
You've been to well. Better watch it. It's really good. It's one of those, just the animation work, I think, deserves its own kind of deep dive and just deconstruction of how they make it work. It's it's really incredible.
Okay.
And of course, the storyline. I think they are taking a leaf of Pixar's kind of approach to storytelling in a lot of ways where, you feel that the characters are, very, very much relatable in a lot of ways. And very, very good.
Okay.
But excited to see what happens then. Do you think Black Mirror will save Netflix?
No.
The share prices are going up.
Yeah, exactly. Like we talked about it before. I don't think Netflix is in as bad trouble as they used to be. I think I was hearing that the password crackdown actually
helped them.
Yeah, really
exactly.
Helped. Because people were like, okay, I better get an account then, and then sign up numbers.
And sales actually went up.
Yeah.
And I remember telling this in the podcast before when we were talking about this last year, is that generally 90% of the time when companies take these steps, they don't just take it because obviously they take it because they want to make money or have some other obligations to shareholders or whatever, but they don't necessarily take it just because they feel like it. They look at the data.
Well, with the Bud Light situation, I don't know if you've... Okay. So I guess Bud Light's target audience was a certain political affiliation and the person who they wanted to, I guess, represent the brand was of a completely different political affiliation, and that's stereotypically, by the way. And that decision has cost them dearly, and their sales are still down. Because usually when people make a fuss on the internet, it's like, oh, we're going to boycott or whatever. It's like a blip. But this actually caused an issue. So.
Yes, and generally speaking, again, like I said in the past as well, like taking a side specifically is beneficial to a company. But I guess in this case with Bud Light's historical audience and target group and demographic, this stance in this case was perhaps not the most, I guess, well thought out. And again, that's not a data-driven decision. This is an ideological decision, right? That's what I was saying, that, okay, if they do take a decision in any case, if it's data-driven, then it usually works out, even if the public outrage is way larger and louder on the internet. But I agree. But I think we have to look at the data in terms of other companies who have done similar kind of steps, and how they perform. Because I've seen numerous companies who've taken similar steps, and they, you know, there's initial blip, and then they perform better. And I think more it has to be said about the retail products. These companies are owned by multi-billion-dollar entities who have thousands of different portfolios targeting different demographics. So if one of their consumer brands fail a little bit, it really doesn't matter. Because ultimately, you're probably thinking that you're consuming something else by someone else, but it's probably owned by the same parent company.
I remember posting, I think, 2010 on Facebook, like this massive graph called the Illusion of Choice, where it was like, you know, all the... every single like chocolate bar / snack company that you knew, like / soda company, and like it all just spread out from like a few different points. It was like five companies own the whole, like,
And apparently the biggest monopolies in terms of, you know, consumer brands in this case is apparently sunglass lens makers.
Yeah, I was going to do it Luxottica. So I was going to do a video on that. That's actually, maybe I should do.
And I think the other one is a zipper brand.
Yeah.
I think these two are the only ones who have very little competition and they're the biggest monopoly. And they provide for the entire world with so many different choices, or at least the illusion of choice in this case.
Sorry, I don't know how we got onto that, but yeah, continue.
I don't know what we're talking about.
Just talking about brands, Netflix brands.
Oh, Netflix boycotting. The password sharing stuff. Yeah. So ultimately, it's working out for them. So, have you seen that they're also opening up a restaurant?
No.
So in Los Angeles, they're opening up a restaurant called Netflix Bites, where they are bringing up the menu will contain foods from various popular food shows on Netflix, and they'll be made by chefs that are generally, you know, celebrities within those shows. I thought, again, that's a very interesting idea.
I don't hate it. Also, just a funny thing, it's in two episodes so far of Black Mirror, but Netflix is called what's it called? Stanberry or something like that? Streamberry.
Okay.
It's called Streamberry, in the same writing and everything. So it's it's kind of meta. There's a lot of meta stuff in there anyway. But yeah, sorry, go on.
Yeah, so I thought that was an interesting way that they're expanding, because, you know, they've tried the games, they're trying a lot of other things as well. And ultimately, again, this was probably, because when they announced, I was thinking, you know, like just once, because Netflix isn't for just one city, right? It's generally for the entire world and different, you know, target demographics around the entire world. So then does this open up scalability possibilities for Netflix Bites, the restaurant? Mm-hmm. And it could be something like, I don't know, like a franchise or a chain that gets built around the world. Because they're starting off at Los Angeles, because obviously it's based in the US. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see how they expand it from here on. Because with internet, it's just so much easier to do that. You know, the Hot Ones TV show, like they sell hot sauce, right? Especially the ones that they use on the show itself. I guess that's a very popular part of their revenue.
Yeah, I guess the thing though with the Netflix restaurant is it has a lot of cuisine from Netflix cooking shows, but how many people, will the target market that watch those cooking shows be enough to kind of sustain that business? Because other people would go there a couple of times. I mean, this is just my assumptions, but they'll go there because it's like, oh, the new Netflix restaurant, let's check it out, and then go a couple of times. It's like, oh, that was all right, and then kind of forget about it. But
yeah, the biggest danger for them is if people treat it as a novelty and not as a regular thing. Because if you just go there once, oh, because, you know, my favorite chef made this, let me just try it once, then I guess that's the fear, because you won't get repeat customers. So that's, I think, something they'll have to solve.
Yeah.
Okay, so we actually ended up talking about a lot of different things in the first part of the show, but obviously the biggest news this week has been the Ocean Gate vessel that's gone missing, mm-hmm. and I guess technically it's been found.
Yeah.
Obviously, for those who are listening and probably already know what's happened, but five people who were aboard a submersible, those missing near the Titanic wreck off the coast of North America, have all died in what appears to have been a catastrophic implosion of that vessel. It's likely located near the shipwreck where the submersible was headed. So ultimately, obviously, you know, there's just so many stuff to talk about, and we're not going to get into the details. But there's two things that I want to talk about specifically. One thing is the reaction of the internet, because, you know, this is a show about all things internet. And the other thing is about the much talked about Logitech controller that controlled the entire thing. Mm-hmm. But from your perspective, I mean, what have you been seeing? What have been your thoughts overall?
I've seen we'll get to the internet stuff later, but I guess just the actual disaster that happened. It's a tragedy. Can I speak today? It's a tragedy that it happened, but not because of, you know, it was just an accident or whatever. But it seems like that this was, everyone knew this was coming. Everyone involved in the project knew that this was going to happen. Like, there were some engineers that resigned in protest because of the materials used and the way that the design methods of the actual vehicle. So the main hull was made out of carbon fiber, which is like a intricately weaved material, like a kind of composite material. Whereas, so interestingly, this information comes from James Cameron, who actually has done the dive multiple times and is, actually seems to know quite a bit about the engineering side behind it.
And for those who don't know, he directed the movie Titanic,
yes. So he was saying that, and it is true, like you should have a hull that's like a uniform material, whether that's steel or titanium or something that's solid. But the problem with carbon fiber is when it gets under stress, it doesn't just crack or deform, it shatters. Mm. So at that depth of 4,000 meters, it's... So there was concerns about that, and the CEO, the guy who was running this business, was saying that, you know, there's no need to go through all the regulations because they hold people back, it stifles innovation. What we need is to come up with something new, and, you know, push the boundaries and take these risks. And ultimately, it didn't end up paying off. And even the testing and the certification of the craft, it wasn't certified by anyone, but apparently he didn't go down to the, as in test at the full 4,000 meters. Like, I think they've done the test before, but as in done the journey before, but this time it didn't work out. I think there was too much cycling.
So wait, this was like the maiden trip?
Sorry?
This wasn't the maiden trip, was it? Like
No. I don't think so.
Because they would have done it multiple times before.
Yeah. So they would have, but I think it was like the repeated stressing and de-stressing of the vessel hull caused the crack. But the thing is, so he said it was rated at 4,000 meters, but that's kind of the depth of the Titanic. So it was kind of like you're getting pretty close to your maximum strain here, or maximum pressure rating. So there were some issues just with the hubris. It's almost mirrors the Titanic story exactly, where it's like this thing is unsinkable, we know what we're doing, and it didn't work out.
And I guess for me, it's from the point I found out to the point obviously where it happened, it was probably the last 3 days, days. We're recording on Friday the 23rd. And just the reaction to the whole thing in terms of...
Just one last thing I remembered. So this is early days, but it seems like the earliest indications of what happened is they had like a warning sensor that would go off when it was detecting that the craft was starting to crack or something was going wrong with the outer casing. And so that detector seemingly went off and they were trying to ascend, because what happened was they dropped their weights or their ballast or whatever it was, and they were on their way up when it
imploded.
So that's kind of sad because that means they kind of had a bit of time and they knew. The thing is, it's like 4 kilometers. Like, how you know? It's,
yeah, and it's just incredible as to how it all unfolded online, for me at least. I think initially, you know, you saw the news, and then just the flurry of memes.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, people just don't care about too soon anymore. It's just, you know, I think
it's almost too sad to think about. Like, I don't know what's going through their heads and why they...
I'm not a psychologist, so I'm not an anthropology expert, but it seems like there's a couple of things here. I think one, from my perspective only, from what I've seen...
It's because they're billionaires, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. That's one, is that, you know, that they're billionaires, and number two was this was an unnecessary risk, is how many people put it, right? Is that they have all the money in the world and they're doing all this stupid stuff according to them anyway. Is that, and why take that unnecessary risk to pay like $250K per ticket when, again, you know, there's people in need of money? And I think I understand the sentiment in terms of, okay, like, people are wasting money to do things that they don't need to do in a world where things are getting increasingly tough. And this almost is like a reaction. But I think wishing death upon people is where definitely you draw the line. I think you can be critical of how they spend their money. You can be critical of everything that certain policymakers and these mega rich people do. But again, like, wishing death is just, and then just making jokes about it at the moment where it's like happening, but we don't even know what's the outcome, right? It just feels. I think the third thing was also, you know, how people tend to compare different stories. So obviously there was a recent migrant boat that capsized, killed well over, I think, close to 100 people. And again, you hear stories like this all the time where you're kind of desensitized, right? Because that didn't get much coverage. But this is like everybody's talking about it, right? So I think there's like three different angles. And I understand the angles. But it just feels like some people just celebrating it, which to me just feels just so off. And again, I don't know if it's just that's where we are. It's like when something happens, almost immediately the first reaction is, oh, let's just make a meme about it because it doesn't impact me.
Well,
that's it.
You know, this is unrelated, but like a while ago I was watching, I guess, the different stages of generational humor. So millennial humor versus Gen Z humor. And a lot of in that discussion was the fact that because there doesn't seem to be much hope in the world right now and life is hard financially and people are feeling like, you know, a little unsettled, like the only way to deal with tragedy or something bad happening is to just mock it. And that's essentially...
It's coping mechanism.
Yeah, it's the coping mechanism of the style of humor specifically for Gen Z internet users. Like, millennial humor, apparently, according to this, was a bit more... random. It was just random, and that was what made it funny. Yeah. But this is more dark humor, and that's kind of the coping mechanism. So we don't know who's posting it, if it is in fact Gen Z people, but I feel like that kind of sentiment is spreading on the internet in terms of when something bad happens, just make fun of it, you know? Like,
yeah. I agree. And there's other stuff that's happened, you know, this I'm not going to get into it, but basically the Schadenfreude of it all is just that. It just seems like more and more people enjoy the downfall of others. Again, it could be
I just think of the fraud videos, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And in some cases it makes sense. You know, if you know, people are happy that somebody who's been frauding around people or doing stuff that, you know, supposed to gets caught, I think that's different. But in the case of somebody who's, you know, in the limelight and then they just slip, everybody's just ready to just pounce. I don't know. I think there's just some sort of joy that comes out of it. And obviously the term is Schadenfreude, I think.
Schadenfreude, yeah.
It's a German term. But it just seems like more and more people have that amplified these days online.
Yeah. And yeah, it's like, I don't know. The thing is, I wasn't paying too much attention to, I guess, I saw like a few of the famous ones, like, everyone in the Titanic, like looking.
Yeah,
I saw a few of the famous ones, but the thing is, yeah, I wasn't paying too close attention. I was more interested in like what went wrong and how it happened. And it was.
But the interesting thing is, maybe a month or 2 months down the line, when I look at the memes, I'll be like, oh, it's a bit funny, right? And then that has happened multiple times in terms of tragic events. Mm-hmm. And I think you're right. I think it's a generational thing, because I think if I shared like a joke about a trauma, like a traumatic event that happened with my parents' times, right, or a historical event that's of big magnitude, and then I shared a joke about it with my parents or people from that generation, I don't think they'll still find it funny. Whereas for millennials, I think there's a lag time an appropriate time to make fun of something. Mm. And I think for Gen Z, there's none.
Yeah.
Like, you're in the middle of the eye of the storm, and yeah, let's make fun of the tornado.
Yeah. No, I think that's true as well. It's just, I don't know. I don't think I understand.
But just coming back to, and of course, have you seen The Simpsons?
Yeah.
There's a video about it.
About how The Simpsons keep predicting all this stuff.
And actually, they don't predict anything, because most of it is actually fabricated. The stuff that you see online, like the Trump, all fabricated. That happened after the thing, but online people say they predicted 20 years ago. And of course, I think there's the thing about the likelihood of an event happening, because they've done so many episodes that you're just increasing the surface area of possibilities.
And as I was seeing The Simpsons, one of Homer going down to look.
Yeah, and it just like it's just and apparently it's like two guys and something like this happened in 1973. Apparently it was like a worldwide event where two guys actually went down, and this was I think it was the biggest rescue mission of all time, like the lowest depth. I have to fact check this, but that was a big news back in 1973 of two guys going down, who were looking
for the Titanic.
Not looking for Titanic per se, but I don't know what the reason was, but that was an international news, and it was a successful mission.
They got them. Well, that's happy ending.
But I have to fact check the whole thing.
But yeah, as I was looking at it, it's like they could make a episode about anything, and it's just like eventually it's gonna happen, you know. But just an interesting bit of trivia, do you know when the Titanic was first found after it sunk?
As in first discovered? That
yes, so it sunk in 1912, and then no one knew where it was for a while. But when did it get discovered again?
60s?
Nope.
When?
Just have another guess.
I don't know. I'm bad at this game, man. Okay.
1985.
Okay.
Yeah. So it took
not the worst.
But it took a long time. Yeah. Like, I guess it's such
technology,
a far depth. It's just like, you don't think about it. 4 kilometers under the sea. It's pitch black.
I've been seeing a lot of those infographic style animation of just comparing how deep the ocean is. Mm. And it actually is fascinating
It's scary.
And I've been seeing a part of my TikTok sometimes shows up where people in deep sea explorations, not deep sea, but more so out in the sea explorations, mm-hmm. where they have to be in like these big, large vessels, you know, either in the oil rigs or whatever. They post videos of the sea at night, where they just take the flash on, and it's literally just nothing around you. You're in the middle, and you're just there looking at that that monitor, just looking at the radar.
So that, you know, the whole liminal spaces thing.
Yeah,
that's the kind of feeling I get with it. Just the visuals I see from you talking about something like that.
I love
the
liminal spaces. Yeah, just this eerie feeling of I don't know, just the dreamy spaces that exist.
But
that's also a big TikTok thing, by the way. Huge trend.
Of course.
Huge trend. Liminal spaces. But look, I'm going to come back to the controller issue, because that has been made fun of.
Apparently it's pretty normal.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what I want to talk about. The thing is, apparently it's the U.S. Navy deploys Xbox controllers on its submarines as replacements for bulky flight sticks. And also the military are also using similar style game pads. And if they're not using the actual controllers, they're mimicking the design of it. Because number one, it's just makes sense in terms of
it's human... It's like, the amount of money Sony and Microsoft have put into R&D for making the perfect controller, you might as well use that.
Exactly. You know? Second, apparently, because the new generation is way more adapted to controls like that, and it's just easier for them to control big things. So just thought that was a very interesting thing that and I guess it makes sense when if people don't know about it. It's like, oh, like, because when I first saw it, it's like, really? Like a $40 stuff that you can get from Walmart and then just use it. But it's just normal, which I didn't know before this. So again, if you didn't know about it, just thought I'd put that in. Now, just moving on to deep and dark spaces. Okay. Reddit went dark.
Good segue.
Okay, I'll take it. Look, last week the pages of Reddit went dark with thousands taking their forums offline to protest against a decision by the platform to impose fees on third-party tools many rely on to make the site more efficient. The protest came after Reddit announced that as of this week, it'll limit access to the site's API or application programming interface, which allows outside companies and users to work with platform data for their own products and services. Reddit needs to be self-sustaining business, and to do that, we can no longer subsidize commercial entities that require large-scale data use. That's what Reddit CEO Steve Huffman wrote in the post. And it met a lot of backlash because for some of the users, it meant paying millions and millions of dollars. And also just for the entire way that Reddit operates, it basically meant that for it to continue as it is, it would require many, many people to pay up a huge amount. And some people are saying that Reddit's also doing this so that it's protecting its data from being used by other companies for training large language models. Uh-huh. And to do that, basically they're saying, you know, this is our data, you have to pay up for using it to train your own programs. Similar to what Twitter's done. And that makes sense because, you know, Steve Huffman apparently is a big fan of what Elon's been doing. It seems like a lot of people are, and I'll get into that after this. But yeah, just the overall way that Reddit's handled this whole thing, just been very interesting to see it play out, because it is a place where so many people go for just day-to-day information, questions. And I just saw a meme the other day where somebody mentioned that, oh, you know, I'm thinking about this very niche problem that I thought I'd only have in this some guy in 2005 who has already asked that question on Reddit. Like, that's how deep the information portal goes in some ways.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on the whole thing, if you have any?
I can understand the view of Reddit. Like, that's a lot of valuable data that they have, and data is the new oil. So that want to kind of take advantage of that. But if it's to the extent of Reddit not being able to keep their lights on if they don't do this, I'm not so sure about. So yeah. Could just be a cash grab. They're publicly traded, aren't they?
Yeah, they would be.
Yeah, so maybe it's just shareholders. I don't know, though.
Could be. But also, I think this is a step that, again, a lot of big platforms are taking, except Meta is doing the exact opposite. They're making everything open.
Yeah, they're big enough. They can.
Yeah, that should be fine. but with Reddit, yeah, I think I think most people are upset because it's destroying the very fabric of Reddit's way of users using the platform, right? And of course, the moderators as well, who basically do this for free, for passion, right? And it'll impact them as well. So eventually what people are looking at is that they're kind of screwing up their own users.
But can you explain, how does it affect the moderators?
I think it basically would mean that the lack of these services would mean that they won't be able to use the API to customize the way that they communicate with the pages, because they use it, like a lot of people use, like in different apps. So if you're just a basic moderator who just runs a basic Reddit app on the side, you're fine. But if you're using the API to customize a lot of the interactions, which plenty of, you know, big Reddit pages do, they also get impacted through this.
So then why can't it just be like, if you are a proven or verified Reddit moderator, then you can use the API, if you're a company.
But then you'd have to pay for it regardless, isn't it? Because there's no system in place for Reddit to do that. So I think one solution could be that.
Yeah, sorry, I meant it as a solution.
Oh, yeah, like, of course. Yeah. And I think that's what a lot of people were saying in another podcast I was listening to. It's called the All In Podcast, where they were saying that they haven't treated, again, I think that's the future of content and content on the internet for this platform, is how you reward the users and the user-generated data. For Reddit, it has so long lived off this, you know, quote-unquote free work of free labor of moderators, that now if you're screwing them over, you're basically losing the entire structure, infrastructure of how Reddit operates. It's imagine if YouTube decides to do something similar, where it's like, no, it's a, we don't pay you to create, instead you have to pay us to be able to be on the site, right? That just destroys the entire structure of how YouTube works. So yeah, I think if Reddit doesn't figure that out, it just seems like they would have some issues. But again, I don't know if it's one of those things where it's just minority people are being just too loud. And again, if it's data-driven decision, because again, Steve apparently said an internal memo that you just have to ride the
storm. I think that's what got people angry.
More angry because it got leaked and people are just even more angry about it. But again, it just tells me that it's that they've made the decision, they're sticking with it, and perhaps they have some data to back up that decision. You can, time will tell.
We'll see.
Other than that, you keen on a cage fight?
I was hoping you would talk about this. This will be, if it goes ahead, this will be one of the wildest things.
I would pay for it.
I would pay for it as I would well. Pay for I'd it. Definitely
Brandon, would
watch.
You pay for it? How much are you willing to pay for it, Brandon?
I'd pay $30.
$30? Would you?
Wasn't it 100 that the...
$100 per pay-per-view?
Or maybe I'm just imagining that, but...
I would pay $100.
But yeah, as much as I would pay, I probably go up to
I'd probably go $100, maximum $100. Australian dollars.
If it's promoted really well, maybe. But I think it's just the fact of seeing two billionaires go at it, and everyone knows who these guys are, you know. It's just like the two of the most world famous people that are the richest people that have these huge companies that, yeah, I don't know, it'll just be amazing to see. And I think Elon probably will lose.
I mean, he's Mark's trained.
Yeah, he's doing jiu-jitsu, whatever the hell he's doing. And
yeah, and apparently he's won a few of these small tournaments as well.
So I think it's bizarre that and that was big news like maybe a month ago or something, or a little less. It's bizarre that Elon would be like, okay, I want to fight him.
Yeah.
And Elon,
but I think Elon talks a lot of BS.
So you think it's not ever going to happen?
I mean, unless Elon trains. I mean, have you seen Elon's body?
Yeah, exactly.
He's not really fit. and he's older, is he? I think he's older than Zuck.
Yeah, he's definitely older than Zuck.
Yeah.
So,
but some people are just literally going, like some you know, people who are into UFC and whatnot, they're actually analyzing the whole thing. They're going, oh, Elon's got the body weight, he can use like this move to take over for Zuckerberg. And someone's like, no, Zuckerberg's got, you know, like, have you seen this clip where his you know,
they should like feed all of that data into an AI and simulate them, see who would come out.
Put Sam Altman on the ring.
Well, looking at the size of him, I don't know. But I think it's just so interesting. It's like living in this, what era would you call this? Like where everyone's yearning to see these two.
I mean, isn't it called the late stage capitalism? Is what I think this is post late stage capitalism.
But this is something else where there's an entertainment angle, and it's like they're also celebrities. It's like back in the day having J.P. Morgan as a celebrity or something during the Gilded Age. But it's what is that? What do you call that?
Yeah, you're right. I don't think I've seen anything like this or heard of anything like this in the past.
It's a weird. Yeah, celebrity culture mixed with extreme capitalism.
I mean, for those, again, who don't know, it's basically Elon Musk tweeted saying that, you know, he's up for a cage fight with Zuckerberg, to which Zuckerberg took a screenshot and posted it on his Instagram saying, send me location. And apparently people have just...
Is that it? Is that the whole interaction?
Yeah, and apparently somebody have confirmed that, you know, a Meta spokesperson said that the story speaks for itself. That's all they said.
Okay, maybe I'm not so confident it's going
to
happen.
And to which Musk responded that Vegas Octagon is what he said. And then he said, I have this great move that I call the Walrus, where I just lie on top of my opponent and do nothing. So obviously I think Elon is just, you know, talking BS. Mm-hmm. But I think Mark's serious. And I think there's a little bit of ego thing going on, but you know, within, and I think it's mostly ego for a lot of these billionaires in some ways, right? And then the question that some people have been posing about the Ocean Gate meetings is, why would you do that kind of stuff? You have all the money in the world. Why are you doing these things? And I think once you have achieved certain things in life, and especially I think billionaires and who have, I don't want to say self-made per se, but people who have achieved certain things with their businesses and have at least in their from their perspective, that they've reached certain milestones, they want to keep on exploring things. Because one of the guys, and Braden was mentioning who's aboard, the thing, he's apparently a living legend. Like he's
the French explorer guy. Yeah.
He's an explorer, right? Like he's gone to the bottom of the Mariana Trench and whatnot. Like some people have that innate thing within themselves. And for a lot of these billionaires, they are like people with a lot of money. They think that, you know, they just want to do things that's almost like doing side quests.
Yeah. Like the thing is, like, think about it. If you've got like billions of dollars, what, like, you know, a lot of people in, like, if they're middle class, upper middle class or whatever, it's like, oh, I'll buy a new house, I'll buy a car and everything, and that excites them. That's, like, really cool. But when you have $1 billion and you've had that for a while, it's kind of like you can buy anything that's nothing. So it's like, what more can you do? And, like, then it starts to get to all these crazier and esoteric things because it's just searching for that.
There's actually a thing, you haven't watched Friends much, have you? But there was this one, for those who have watched Friends, probably know what I'm talking about, but there was this one part in an episode where basically one of the characters, she meets this billionaire in a cafe that she was working at. And he basically, and it's again, it's going to spoil the thing, but it's long. This came out like ages ago. But basically, she thinks after dating a while, she thinks that he's going to propose to her, right? Because this thing came out about him looking for a ring. So she thought that he was, you know, spending all this money for this big ring. But turns out he wants to fight in, you know, like become a full-on professional fighter. And he was spending all this money to build a custom ring where they can get in and fight, right? But that showed, and the rest of the crew, they're like, oh, like he's gone mad. But for him, it's like, no, this is what I have to do. This is my life. And they eventually break up because he wanted to do this. So that this reminds me of that. Like, I think they captured that essence quite well, thinking back about it. So people do all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So this reminds me clearly of that.
Like, that's pretty spot on.
But it's funny because Mark Zuckerberg's been talking up Elon. Have you heard his second appearance on Lex Fridman that came out very precisely the day after Apple?
Yeah, I think that's what stole the headlines, though, him talking about, you know, the Apple Vision Pro and what he thought about it. But yeah, I didn't listen to the whole thing. So
In part of that podcast episode, again, it's always interesting to hear them. But in part, he said that he's actually quite liked how Elon took over Twitter, and he thinks it could end up, I mean, it should have the potential to have billions of users ultimately. He says then the leaner take on Twitter, he thought that there were generally good changes. So big praise coming for Elon by Zuckerberg. So I don't know.
Yeah, I haven't been following how Twitter's doing, like in terms of many things. So yeah. I don't know if he's right or not.
Before moving into our AI corner, AI zone, I just want to talk about this whole Messi thing. I know you don't follow soccer as much or football as much. And I guess those who are listening in, I don't know if you do follow or not, but most of you are based in the US, so you probably would have heard a little bit about it. Do you know what's happened at all?
No.
Okay, so you know who Lionel Messi is.
Of course, yeah.
Okay, only one of the greatest players of all time. Apparently saying that in its of itself is a bit of a debate these days.
Ronaldo.
So I'm a big soccer fan. Been following, you know, since I was a kid. I play, you know, I go for certain teams. But basically what's happened is, you know, Lionel Messi, and he's pretty much won everything he has to win, right? At club level in Europe, you know, the World Cup. The World Cup. But in terms of club football, you know, Europe's definitely considered as the grade A place to be. And he's won most almost all the things that he needs to there from his perspective. Now, he, at this age, this is the transfer season, he basically is moving to the US, which is not known for its soccer. It's got the MLS, which is the Major League Soccer League. And he's making a big transfer move. Now, between that and Saudi Arabia, which also offered him huge amounts of money, he turned down close to a $2 billion deal from Saudi Arabia to move to MLS for getting paid roughly, what, $54 million per season? So that comes out to, like, I think over the course of the contract, you know, definitely not $2 billion, right? So the interesting thing is part of that contract was actually funded by, not funded, but the contract will include things from Apple and Adidas. So Apple, they took over the broadcasting rights of the MLS. So they will now do a revenue percentage share as part of the contract for Messi coming into the MLS. So that was a big, big thing, because prior to this, you know, this there would be signups, but now it's just going to drive up the signups to an insane level. And the second thing is Adidas, who are also partnered with MLS, and they also sponsor Messi. They're also giving him an extra amount of money. But the most interesting part of it all is the team that he's going to. So it's called Inter Miami. It was the 25th club of the franchise. So basically, that means, you know, like, you can add clubs to the roster, and it's owned by David Beckham. Now, David Beckham, he played in the MLS. In 2007, he made a similar move where, you know, he wasn't towards the end of his career, but he still had a lot to give. He could have played in a club in Europe, but he moved to the US at that time. And then part of his contract included buying a future MLS club or forming a club at a cheaper price. When he left the club as a player, retired, he got the option to buy a club in MLS for $35 million. This is a cheaper price, right? And at that time, it was around you know, $500 million to enter a team. So he got it like a very cheap price, right? Now, listen to this. By the time Inter Miami played their first game, which is in 2020, the club was the 10th most valuable MLS franchise already and was valued at $857 million. So almost, I don't know how many percentage, but 35, 857, huge in 7 years. That's 24 more times. And now with Messi joining, it could be valued at $1.5 billion. So this whole thing was kind of orchestrated by Beckham in some ways in 2007. And he's kind of doing the same thing with Messi, who will also have a similar option of buying it in the future. So you're looking at kind of like this way of regenerating
capital. It's like investing, yeah.
Investing. Yeah. And the thing is, what Saudi Arabia is doing, like, basically the state is funding their own league in similar ways, and they're bringing in, like, because Ronaldo plays in Saudi Arabia now. There's so many players.
So is that a Saudi Arabian league?
League, yeah. And they're, like, bringing in, the money they're paying are just incredible sums, like, incredible amount. So it's this whole thing about sports washing and whatnot, but the business of soccer and football is, you know, we thought that it's going to kind of, you know, come down after a little bit of a lot of investments from private owners, but now state-backed clubs and leagues are popping up, and that's not the MLS, but there's so many things happening in there I thought was very interesting business-wise.
Yeah, okay, I had no idea about that. But this whole MLS thing, is it that good? Like, are the teams
actually...
In terms
of quality, no.
Yeah, so wouldn't Messi just be running through everyone?
And, that's the thing, yeah. But he's, you know, he's 36, older, he's older, but he'll still definitely be easily the best, or at least one of the best players there, right?
Yeah.
And he's, because they have a league structure of payment of to players, and he can get like a certain amount of players who don't follow under that cap, and he's getting paid like $40 million more than the next person.
It's kind of like Michael Jordan, like, close to retirement, is like, oh, I'm going to play with the kindergartners now. It's like,
I mean, again, the business of Michael Jordan, I've been seeing, like, he recently sold one of the clubs. I think it's the Chicago Hornets or something. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't follow basketball, so please excuse me if I'm butchering this information. But I was reading up on that, and he's made some insane profits.
Right. He's a brand by himself. So.
Yeah, like the Nike Jordan deals are just incredible. But yeah, that's a bit of, I guess, detour.
I think that's the first sports news.
First sports news. I mean, I do talk about my not as much. So, have you heard about Meta's AI voice box?
Yeah, was that the one where they're like, oh, we got this technology to clone voices of loved ones, but it's going to be too much of a risk to to release?
Yeah, it's interesting because to me it seems like a PR move where people are bringing up so much about ethical issues. They're like, oh, we've got this thing, but we're not going to show it because we are ethical.
Yeah. Sorry. I'm not sure about that, but I don't know. I think it's not... These days, it's not so hard to do. Like, a huge company like Facebook would be able to pull off that kind of technology quite easily. If, like, something like Whisper can come out and do it, they can. So.
I mean, what is Beth's AI would really look like for a consumer? I mean, because Snapchat's doing something similar, right?
Yeah, but that's the hard thing. Like, they have to come out with a completely new product. Because if you're going to use it for Facebook, what's it really going to do? Like, generate images of... What?
That's the same thing with Snap AI that they launched, you know, a few months ago, where essentially it just is your, go-to kind of...
It talks to you, right?
It talks to you, kind of talks back to you.
But Snap, it makes a bit more sense for Snapchat.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Like, what else can Facebook do other than something similar to Snap AI?
Mm.
I don't think of much.
Unless it's like, you know... to do with their VR stuff where it's like it gives you like a customized experience.
Which it'll come, I'm sure. I mean, they are going to double down on the VR and AI stuff, so.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just one of those things where it's like you don't know until you see it. It's.
All right, next on the AI stuff is that Beatles song.
Is it the one that Lennon wrote but never...
So according to Paul McCartney, for those who would know, he's part of the Beatles, he announced on BBC there was a demo that John Lennon had worked on and they're just finishing it up and it'll be released this year and it'll be the last Beatles song ever. We were able to take John's voice and get it pure through this AI so that when we could mix the record as you would normally do, it gives you some sort of leeway, so there's a good side to it, and there's a scary side, and we'll just have to see where that leads. And apparently this came with a lot of, you know, varying reactions. Some people were just upset. Oh, it's AI, it's taking over, like, what's Beatles doing? And some people were like, oh, this is what AI is supposed to do. Mm. And I think he came out later and said that, you know, there's some confusion. We're not recreating something from scratch. Basically, John's done some work and we're just cleaning it up with AI to whatever degree, I don't know. But I just thought, you know, that's, I guess, what's AI supposed to be
and
for,
I think this is somewhat okay. Like, if I feel better about this one because it's actually someone who was with him at the time, you know, and this is stuff that he's written. So it's like, if you can make it better, like, make it, clean it up and make it listenable, why not? Like, I don't think it's such a bad deal. But on the other hand, if you had some dude in his bedroom who, like, just made some new Beatles album and...
What if it's better than all the Beatles album that come out?
But he wouldn't have done it, though. Like... It would have been the AI. Well, it depends on what section you're talking about. If it's just the AI doing the voice and it's Paul McCartney or something, but his composition is better than the Beatles, then good on him. I don't think that's it.
I mean, you say the AI has done it, but I think there's still so much that, at least at this stage, there's so much that goes into recreating something that's
yeah. So that's kind of what I meant by which stage. Like, if it's right. just the vocals that the AI has done and he's done the rest, that's all right. But I think in terms of AI and music, like, I've harped on about this, like, so far we've got nothing close to it. Like, and I honestly think that it's going to be a lot harder than people think.
Right.
I think it's going to be one of the last standing bastions. Like, you can get stuff that's 50 to 60% good, maybe in a couple of years. But if you want to get something that is, like, you can just press a button and it generates something that is as good as anything else, that doesn't sound like stock music. Because there's a difference between stock music and well-produced music. Mm. And if you don't know what that difference is, like, it seems like, oh, that's easy, just, you know, make it better. But, like, the amount of finessing you have to do to get to shape things and to get it to end up not sounding like stock music, that's a lot of work. And it's that extra 20% that I think AI would struggle with, because it's like, it's almost like, yeah, I don't know, it's hard to explain, but I just don't think it's going to happen soon.
I can agree with that. And I think a lot of people, again, are also just a bit tired of AI at this point, in the sense that, you know, so much has kind of come out, and I think people have adapted to it in the sense of reaction that they just think, oh, it's just another thing, right? Mm-hmm. And it is true to some extent, but I think, I don't know, I'm still fascinated by
Of course,
And again, you remember when I said that some people are just not going to care?
Yeah.
I'm seeing that a lot. Yeah. Like, it's like, oh, there's been a few months where I don't see anything. Like, just the other day, I saw like a status update from a graphic designer who's very talented. And he's like, oh, like, I've been seeing all this AI stuff, but none of them have come close to a human. And I don't think it will.
So this is for design, or
yeah, for design.
What kind, like graphic design, or
the status update was just about basic
right.
Stuff. But again, I felt he's actually mostly an illustrator. Mm-hmm. But overall, it just seems to me like reactions like that mm-hmm. is again very very common. Where like some of the tech stuff's just been so highly hyped up. By tech companies, that some part of it does feel like that, and other mm-hmm. parts just, yeah.
Yeah, I think we're going to need that next leg where it's like, oh, everyone's flowing again. Because it was like...
I don't think this is going to happen.
Ever?
Yeah, because again, it just feels like if you can't connect to it, I don't think it matters.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, when that company first makes that special home speaker that can talk to you in real language and... It becomes popular, something like that. I think everyone would be like, "Wow!"
Oh yeah, in terms of like a physical embodiment of it, or something that really—it's
not groundbreaking, but it captures the imagination. You know?
That's right.
That's what I'm talking about. So something like that. It's kind of like,
and I guess for us as creators and people who are very enthusiastic about the tech and what happens in the background, for us it's such a crazy leap that has happened over the last year. Mm-hmm. But again, more and more I talk to people where they're like, oh, ChatGPT is cool, but that's about it. And
yeah.
And it's kind of like, everything else is like, oh, it's just...
It's getting to that stage where it's like, computers always did that.
Yeah, and you mentioned that as well in the past, and I'm just seeing more of it happen. Because yeah. The example that I drew last time was, you know, 10, 15 years ago, I remember again, this I had a Facebook picture on my profile where I had sat down and drawn with Photoshop, you know, with my own hand that I, you know, basically cartoonized myself, right? And I posted that on Facebook. People were like, oh, this is so cool. Can I make you one? Can I make you one? And now, like with Lensa and whatnot, oh, it's just like that. So the degree to which people are adapting to AI being normal, and because of the characteristics it has in terms of the output, people are just used to it already. Like, oh, it's just another thing. The other day I used Runway to make like a short, I don't know if you watched it.
Yeah, I saw that.
I personally loved how it looked in terms of, you know, mm-hmm. as a storyboarding option, mm-hmm. but as a final product, or even as a storyboarding option, some people are like, oh, you know, it's, you can just take a few stock photos and or stock images and or stock videos, and you can just do that.
Yeah.
But the fact that I haven't used a reference image at all and just mm-hmm. typed up a few things and gave me that.
Yeah, mind-blowing.
I just don't see.
So I'm going to ask you something. Do you actually know of any good AI, apart from Kyber and Runway, do you know any good AI video producing software, like from scratch?
No, but Runway's the only one. I've used Kyber. I think you have for your music video thing.
That's the thing.
Because Runway still has so much, because you can only output up to 3 seconds.
That's the
problem. You have to pay a lot. So to make a full length short documentary or whatever, you'll have to pay thousands and thousands of dollars.
It's not sustainable.
No.
So I'm just looking for what's
coming. It'll get there to a point. But yeah, right now it's just for quick internet, you know, reels and again, because it's just easy consumable stuff, people can't connect to it and they'll be like, oh, you know, it's just another piece of content that just spread it out kind of thing, right? Look, final part of the AI story today. Have you seen that AI can now predict your political affiliation just by looking at your face?
I've heard over the years different AI systems. No, different AI systems looking at faces and saying, oh, this side is uglier. Like, they tend to be uglier or the other side. But I haven't heard of this.
Yeah, so a team of researchers based in Denmark and Sweden conducted a study to see that if deep learning technologies like facial recognition technology and predictive analytics can be used on faces to predict a person's political views. To do this, the researchers used a public data set of 3,000 plus images of Danish political candidates who ran for local office and cropped them to show only their faces. After that, they applied advanced techniques and it ended up giving a person's quote-unquote beauty score. Using these points, the scientists predicted whether the figures pictured were left-wing or right-wing, and the study found the tech accurately predicted their affiliations to 61% of the time.
61. Yeah. Slightly better than chance.
it's
interesting. But so let me try and get this straight. Is it they had a data set of political candidates, mm-hmm. and then based on that, they were predicting just random people?
Random people. After.
So I guess the thesis would be that people tend to vote for people that look like them. That's all you can really come out with from this. But I don't know
how far this will go, but I guess this is the kind of stuff that people are just working on as well.
Yeah, I don't put much stock in that, to be honest. But it's, you know, people are going to experiment with these things and say, like, what are the patterns that people cannot recognize that AI can? And that's the really interesting, weird space that we could get some interesting results from. But this is a bit, I don't know, maybe just for headlines or something.
All right, so that's it from the AI side of things. But before we part ways, this is just one thing that popped up on my Facebook about the OceanGate vessel missing. Somebody named Deborah Grattan posted in November 1st, 2013, and this is her status update, right? I had a dream that an evil billionaire started doing submarine trips down to Titanic and somehow pumped water out of parts of it, but then it turned into disaster on its maiden outing. Probably will make a good movie.
Hmm.
That's it. No edit history, no nothing. And they were about it 100%. And even the comments there from 9 years ago, somebody said, Tom Cruise should start this. They sound like an episode of Sequest DSV. So I was like, I never watched it really. So this is Deborah saying, I never watched it really. It was a very creepy dream, though. You didn't know you could get inside until just before you did. And then all the walls collapsed and water was everywhere. And everything was really dark and ominous.
Well,
it's been going viral.
Yeah, that's kind of crazy.
Because usually stuff like this, it goes viral and then you look at view edit history.
Yeah, and it's the other way around.
But this one, there's no view edit history. And I'll share the link. It's incredible. It just popped out. So.
Yeah, well, there you go.
Better than Simpsons.
That is better than The Simpsons. All right, well, on that cheerful note, we shall end the episode. Thanks for watching and hope you enjoyed it. And we'll see you again next time. Cheers.